Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This week, X-Ray Woman meets the Green Comet. Sounds like a great title for a comic book, doesn't it? Actually, it's better than that. It's a visitor from the outskirts of the solar system. You'll meet a different breed of comet chaser. Plus, Roger Blanford is laying out the roadmap for the future of astronomy. We'll hitch a ride and see where the science is going. Along the way, we'll find out why black holes are a force for good. So stay with us. It's The Universe in Mind, where even black holes have a bright side. If you were out stargazing in recent weeks, you might have been lucky enough to see Comet Lulin as it reached its peak brightness in the night sky. The comet was discovered at the Lulin Observatory in Taiwan way back in 2007. This January, it reached its closest point to the sun, and then it grew steadily brighter as it raced past Earth. In images taken by backyard astronomers around the world, the comet has a distinctly greenish tinge, and there are now lots of great pictures of this green comet to see online. But meanwhile, one group of astronomers has been looking at Comet Lulin in a very different way, using NASA's SWIFT spacecraft. That's an orbiting satellite that was designed to study gamma-ray bursts. But as it turns out, it's not so bad at looking at comets either. Jenny Carter is an astrophysicist at the University of Leicester in the UK, and she's part of the team that's involved in SWIFT's comet watching. So Jenny, welcome to The Universe in Mind.
Hi.
So let's start with SWIFT, Jenny. Now, first of all, it doesn't see the universe as the human eye does. It's looking for gamma rays and X-rays and so on. How is it exactly that SWIFT is perceiving Comet Lulin?
Well, SWIFT is using its X-ray telescope, the XRT, and the UVOT, the UVOT telescope. And so this is a wave band that the human eye can't detect at all. But with these telescopes, we hope to pick up the X-ray emission and UV emission that's being emitted from the comet.
So how does the comet look?
The comet looks like a big ball of gas from our point of view. It's a very diffuse, extended gas ball of gas, and it's emitting in X-rays and it's emitting in UV as well.
Now, we usually associate X-rays with things that are very hot, which is what gamma-ray bursts are, and, you know, the sun emits X-rays and so on. A comet, if I'm not mistaken, is basically a pretty cold object. It's mainly made of ice, and it's coming to us from the outermost fringes of the solar system. So what exactly is producing those high-energy X-rays and the ultraviolet light?
Okay, well, the X-rays in the comet are actually produced when the solar wind that's coming from the sun interacts with atoms and molecules that are being released by the comet. So what happens in this case is a charge exchange takes place, which we call the solar wind charge exchange, or commonly known as SWIX. So what happens is an electron from a neutral atom around the comet will be transferred to an ion from the solar wind, and in the subsequent decay of the electron in the ion, an X-ray is emitted, or sometimes a far UV photon. The UV itself tells us more about the constituents of the comet itself. The water is broken up so we can see the hydrogen and the hydroxyl molecules that are there.
So basically you're watching, you know, the comet on a molecular level falling apart under the sun's influence.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the UV radiation is bombarding the comet all the time, and this is breaking up all the gas and the molecules that are being released by the comet, and we can see these.
So what is it that you're hoping to learn about Comet Lulin by observing it in this way?
Well, with the X-rays, we monitor the condition of the solar wind at the time of the observations. The solar wind is highly variable and can change over an hour, for example. The UV tells us more about the constituents of the comet itself, and so we can make estimations about the gas production rate, how much gas the comet is giving off as it travels through the inner solar system.
And is there something special about this comet that would make it an interesting target for you and for SWIFT? I mean, what makes it different from the average comet passing through?
Well, this comet is interesting because it's on its first pass through the solar system, or we believe it's on its first pass through the solar system. So it has lots of gas and lots of dust, and so therefore we expect the gas production rates to be high. It also is on the ecliptic plane, which means that the solar wind that the comet is experiencing is similar to the solar wind that the Earth will be experiencing. And therefore, it's another monitor of the condition of the solar wind. And the comet also, it's not particularly unusual, but the comet contains cyanogen and diatomic carbon, which have been seen before in comets, but which give it its nice green glow, which also makes it interesting.
So now, is that why this comet, in all of the pictures that have been showing up online, is that why it looks so green? Because, as you were saying, this is a comet that maybe on its first pass through the inner solar system, it has a lot of gas. So does that give it that greenish glow?
Yes, it's the cyanogen and the diatomic carbon which give the green glow and result in fantastic pictures in optical wave bands, which we've seen on the web and in various different forums.
Now, how does it feel for you? Because, of course, as you say, if this is a comet that's on its first pass through the solar system, you know, you're really looking at it in a unique way, something that has, of course, it's never been seen by human eyes before, and presumably it's never been seen by any eyes before. It's really kind of a messenger from the early, early days of the solar system. Are you finding that an exciting opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. For me, it's very exciting. And we hope to get as much information as we can from this comet. And like you said, comets tell us about basically the conditions in the early solar system. So we're hoping to learn, gather some clues, more clues, as we observe this comet and maybe other comets in the future.
Now, will there be more observations, or have you now wrapped up, or are you still trying to gather some more?
Well, our latest observation was actually today, and we are planning a possible observation in a couple of weeks. So to do that, we, like other astronomers, we apply for time on the SWIFT telescope, and the science committee there makes a judgment about whether they can actually see the comet and whether they think it's worth scientifically seeing the comet. So we apply for time, and the SWIFT team is very quick and very good at doing this, and they email us back a day or two later and tell us that our mission, our observation has been scheduled.
Great. So I have to ask you before we leave you, I know Leicester in wintertime is not necessarily the best place to be looking at the night sky. You get a lot of clouds at this time of year. But have you had a chance, between all of your work with SWIFT, have you had a chance to pop out and try and see the comet with your own eyes?
Well, I did go outside on the 24th of February, which was the day of closest approach, but it was completely cloudy. And so I quickly went back inside because it was quite cold outside. But I keep looking up at the sky and hoping for a clear night. Sometimes in England we have a clear sky in the morning and then by the evening it's cloudy again. So I travel around with my binoculars and hope for a clear moment.
So you haven't seen it yet, but of course you've got a secret weapon that the rest of us don't have, which is your X-ray and ultraviolet observatory orbiting up in space.
Yeah, exactly. We have an advantage over other people in England, definitely.
Well, Jenny, thank you so much for telling us about this, and good luck getting more observations.
Thank you very much.
Jenny Carter spoke to us from the University of Leicester in England. Up next, the brighter side of black holes. Roger Blanford is a popular man these days. He's director of the Kavli Institute of Particle Physics and Cosmology at Stanford University. But he's also been charged with heading up what's called the Decadal Survey. It amounts to a review of the state of American astronomy and a look ahead to where it should be going over the next 10 years. Importantly, Blanford's report will be used by the agencies that fund astronomy in the U.S. to help decide where their money should go. And he's had no shortage of suggestions. This week I caught up with Roger Blanford while he was visiting here in Toronto, and we spoke about the future of astronomy. but our conversation began with one of Blanford's favorite scientific subjects. Roger Blanford, I'd like to start with black holes. I know you're here in Toronto to meet with colleagues, but also to give a public talk called Black Holes, End of Time or New Beginning. And I want to ask you what you mean by that. How can a black hole be a new beginning?
Well, I think it's embedded in popular culture by now that a black hole is an agency of death and destruction and, if you like, a refuse bin and has very negative connotations. But in practice, in the universe, black holes are also very much part of regeneration and life. And one of the thoughts that I want to try and convey in this talk is that if one views the galaxies, the universe of galaxies, as a sort of living environment, then the actions of black holes are responsible for the birth of stars, of new galaxies, and in an indirect way, they contribute to the development of life.
Now, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. I think people have a sense, even going back to Carl Sagan talking about the fact that we're all made of star stuff, people have a sense that we are, as living beings, connected to the universe, that the atoms that are in our bodies come from stars and are, in a sense, processed through stars. But black holes, as you say, have been regarded somewhat differently, almost as a kind of dead end in that process, and maybe a kind of dead end that you don't want to venture down because it's a bit dangerous. How is it that black holes can actually be constructive in this process?
Well, the way that this typically works is in the very formation of the black holes and in their subsequent operation as centers of gravity, they attract gaseous fuel towards them. This fuel typically forms spinning disks of matter around. The gas that falls into the black holes on the way creates vast amounts of radiation with much greater efficiency than, for example, one will associate with nuclear power. And in addition, there are large outflows of gas associated with the black holes, and so you may get a small proportion of the mass altruistically sacrificing itself to allow most of its brothers and sisters to escape. And so we see black holes as highly luminous and sources, and that the radiation and the outflows that they create are, in direct and indirect ways, responsible for, as I said, the creation of new galaxies and stars, perhaps.
So it sounds like you're trying to rehabilitate our image of black holes.
Only in a figurative way. I mean, they are also, of course, as you said, rather dangerous places to enter. I think there is no difference in the view that if there were a black hole nearby in any material, or if you want more pointedly, human being were to cross the event horizon, then they indeed would be doomed, yes.
Now, these days, there's so much excitement around, you know, the most exotic discoveries in the universe, dark energy, dark matter, for example. There's also a lot of excitement about exoplanets, the possible discovery of habitable worlds around other stars. Where do black holes fit in to that array of astronomical problems? Is it now a mature field? Is there a lot still to be done? What would be enticing researchers to work on black holes at this stage?
Oh, I think probably at this point, I think it's the opportunity for discovery. We are learning a lot with new windows on the universe, phenomena that are probably associated ultimately with black holes. One of the big growth areas is gamma ray astronomy, and we are seeing many of the sources that gamma ray astronomers are discovering are the so-called relativistic jets that squirt out of the regions around black holes. These are part of the outflows associated with black holes, and they propagate way outside the galaxies and so on. And so that's one area, and we can see this happening. We know it's associated with the black hole, but from, if you like, an astroengineering perspective, we really don't know quite how nature performs these tricks. We don't see what the blueprint is. And I think there's a great fascination in trying to understand what is the mechanism for a black hole creating a jet out of a disk of gas that surrounds it, in much the same sense that there was a curiosity in the past about how did the sun keep hot for 1,000 times as long as it should have done.
Right.
And, of course, the answer we now understand in quite a lot of detail is due to nuclear reactions. But there was a long while when we didn't know that at all. And it was a fascinating puzzle which was eventually was solved. And we hope to do the same. The same sort of level with understanding how black holes make these relativistic jets. There are other opportunities, windows on the study of black holes, and that is gravitational radiation. Here we have the opportunity with facilities that have already been constructed on the ground to detect gravitational radiation from perhaps the formation of black holes or other processes associated with them, and we hope one day will be constructed in space for seeing the massive black holes in the nuclei of distant galaxies, in particular when they coalesce and merge. They should produce great bursts of gravitational radiation, and we can study and check the correctness of the jet theory of general relativity by looking for the gravitational radiation from these events.
Right. Now, since we're speaking about these future puzzles that remain to be solved, I would like to also ask you about the Blanford Report, about this anticipated document which you're embarking on, not like the Colbert Report, I guess, but something that's of great interest to astronomers. This is the Decadal Survey. What is the philosophy behind this? Why is there a sense that every 10 years this taking of stock is required to lay the groundwork for the future?
That's a very good question, and there have been concerns raised as to whether or not 10 years is the right interval. On the one hand, there's a push towards doing it on a shorter timescale because that's, in some sense, the timescale on which the science is changing. We're in such a rapidly changing field, and the pace of discovery is so great that you might say on scientific grounds, you should do it every 5 years. Against that, you might say that, a lot of these projects take more than a decade to complete. So some of the very biggest telescopes, to plan them, to build them, to finance them, and then to start operating them is a 20 or in some cases even longer interval of time to do it. So it should be a 20-year report. Well, I think sort of averaging those two, perhaps taking the geometrical mean, we'll end up with a decade. So it's a compromise. It's not perfect, and we have to allow for the rapid pace of discovery and the slow pace of realizing the dreams of astronomers for new telescopes, and a decade seems about right.
So it seems to me that one way in which this process is fraught with peril is this problem of trying to anticipate the future, that if we look at what's happened over the last 10 years, and if we imagine that the next 10 years is equally fruitful, how do you anticipate for all that's going to come?
Well, I don't think you can anticipate it for all the unscripted discoveries that are going to come. And you wouldn't be research if you could. And that's part of the excitement of this business. But there's already plenty that we can discuss and plenty where new facilities are extremely well motivated by what we know already, that we can at least make choices amongst those opportunities. And that's what we'll be obviously starting to do. Looking further into the future, we will obviously be leaving space, leaving contingency for new discoveries. And there are all sorts of discoveries that one could imagine happening that will leapfrog in some sense to the head of the queue. They would be so exciting.
So given everything that's going on in so many different areas of astronomy, how do you set up an assessment to recommend what should happen next or where emphasis should be given next? Is it a case where, you're expected to support a few major projects, or would it make more sense to have more projects but perhaps at a lower cost? Or, how do you
How do you balance those?
No, I think it's a very good question. Let me first say a little bit about the process, and then I'll turn to your direct question. The process itself, I think, it's very important that this be an inclusive process. It involved the astronomical community, and we've gone to some considerable pains to engage the whole community and to give them the opportunity of expressing their views. And we, in fact, now are reading a whole series of submitted white papers and so on a vast range of subjects to inform ourselves not only about the science that's out there, but also about the priorities of our colleagues. So in some sense, what we report will be not a small group of people in a smoke-filled room, but in fact the whole community speaking. Your question then came on to balance, and it's something that we will pay a lot of attention to. There are some fields of science, one might say particle physics was an example of this, where it really makes the most scientific sense to put all your resources in relatively few giant facilities. It's just the way the field is and the way that you proceed most expeditiously forward. There are other fields of science where, frankly, you don't want mega institutes and mega facilities. You really want to disperse the funds mm-hmm. broadly into very small groups, a professor and a couple of students or whatever, and you optimize the science that way. Astronomy probably lies between those two extremes, and it needs a balance. It needs the big facilities, the Hubbles and the James Webb Space Telescopes and so on, but it also needs very small facilities and small research groups as well. And a lot of the discoveries, if you look over the past 10 or 20 years, have actually come from small telescopes, small facilities, small groups of people. They may have required the big telescopes to follow them up, but they wouldn't have happened without the small groups. And one of the things that one of the aspects of this report that we will have to pay a lot of attention to is not just recommending a balance, but putting in place in those recommendations a mechanism for maintaining that balance. Because one of the things that happens in all countries is that when economic times get bad, and I don't have to remind you that this is a particular time when we're in somewhat fraught economic circumstances,
sure.
When economic times get bad, usually it's the big facilities that survive and it's the smaller efforts that fall by the wayside. And so that may be bad for the field, and so we will have to try and think of mechanisms for maintaining that balance through bad times. But that's one of the things we will be trying to do, and I think we have to find the right balance, and different subfields of astronomy require a different balance, I think. And so we'll be paying some attention to that.
Well, and speaking of big facilities, I imagine a question that is in the background, and I'm not sure to what extent you'll be able to address it, but people are beginning to work on the next generation of really large telescopes, and there are a couple of efforts underway that involve North American participants. So the 30-meter telescope is one. Giant Magellan Telescope is another. These are both enormous, enormous, expensive, complex telescopes that would completely, I think, take astronomy to a new level. I guess the question is, could they both be built? And if they can't, will your review speak to that issue?
Well, yes, that is the question. And in fact, there's a third player in this business, which is a European telescope,
right,
which is now nominally 42 meters, which is even larger.
Right.
So, yes, that is very much the question. And it's one it won't be the answer we'll be given, because our recommendation will be to the U.S. agencies and so on as to what the United States should do. And the U.S. agencies should support. Mm-hmm. And I obviously don't know the answer to that question as yet. I have to rely and wait upon the wisdom of my colleagues. But it is a question that we can't duck, and we must have an opinion on that, and we must make some recommendation, and we will do that.
Now, as you've already said, the United States and the world at large is heading for, by all accounts, a very difficult period economically. How do you make the case for curiosity-based science, for a science like astronomy, which is well beyond the daily life of most people? How do you make a case for that in such times?
I think that's a very good question, and I think there are many different ways of looking at that. Very important way of thinking about doing fundamental science or doing curiosity-based science, if you call it, is that it actually does in an indirect way impact on more utilitarian science. I can just give one example that I've been thinking about quite a bit over the past few months. There is obviously going to be a need for people who are going to work on climate research. There has been perhaps a dearth of activity in the United States, not necessarily in other countries, under the last administration, but this one, the present administration, has made no secret of the fact that they really want to think about the environment, they want to think about the impact of climate change and so on, they want to think about monitoring, they want to think about observations. Well, astronomers actually do have some experience in this business. We do understand about atmospheres. We do understand about exotic atomic physics. We do understand about remote sensing. We do understand about observing scads of data. And I think that many of the people working in astronomy could usefully transition and contribute to environmental science, because after all, astronomy itself is an environmental science, and vice versa. And I think that's just one example of many ways that supporting people with different perspectives from a different scientific discipline can contribute to, by moving fields in some sense, or at least participating in it. I think that's just one way. Another way is, I think that there's little doubt in my mind that astronomy and astrophysics are an educational loss leader for science and technology writ large. And one of the advantages of astronomy is it is so easily communicable, partly with the power of the image, partly the sort of magnificence of the ideas and so on, and the discoveries, the exotic discoveries that are made. But also, I think there's a sort of innate human fascination in this, and it particularly brings out the child not only in adults but also in children.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. Many people who have been highly accomplished engineers, scientists of a quite different ilk, have really been caught up in the business by astronomy as children. And I think it is one of the missions of astronomy is to excite people about the power of discovery, and that, one hopes, will carry on not just to make professional astronomers, but on a much larger scale, to have those people carry that fascination, that way of thinking about the world around us, into quite different areas. They may not even be scientific areas, but I think it has very powerful lessons that will be useful as we confront the major challenges in the world ahead.
So just as we have black holes as the creators or as a creative force in the galaxy, we've got astronomy as a creative force within science and society.
I would like to think so. I think that is a very nice way of putting it.
Roger Blanford, thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Roger Blanford is chair of the Astro 2010 Committee, a 10-year survey of where U.S. astronomy should be headed next. And if you're curious about what's on Roger Blanford's reading list, you're in luck, because over 300 white papers have just gone online at the Astro 2010 website. These are papers written by researchers around the U.S. suggesting to Roger Blanford and his group what the new frontiers of cosmic exploration should be. And it's a fascinating list, from billion galaxy surveys to neutrino telescopes to astrobiology. To find it, just Google Astro 2010 and look for Science White Papers. And that's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is brought to you by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parent is our online producer. Thanks also to Hugh Zhao here in Toronto, and this week as well to Chris Gooch and Carl Vivian at the University of Leicester. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget, with graphics by Epahan Elby. I'm Ivan Semenik. Be sure to check in with me next week for more news and conversations about the world of astronomy. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.